And the songs that were chosen this morning are very appropriate for our passage today, which will be in Mark 5. We're not going to go there right yet, but the passage about Jesus and the man with a legion of demons. And so I was just thinking about that with all the songs that we sang. They were almost perfectly choreographed. But before we get into Mark chapter 5, this week's question, the Ask the Pastor question, comes from Ephesians 4, 26 and 27, where it says, "Be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your wrath, nor give place to the devil." Now, this is a great question this week because someone in the congregation had heard a teaching from another teacher, possibly on the radio, that taught that not letting the sun go down on your wrath means to not ever let righteous anger go. You should always hold on to that. Now, even though I'd never heard that take before, I don't just discount things just because I'm not familiar with them, and I don't think that that's wise for any of us if we want to learn. We want to be Bereans, so we want to search it out. But our first reaction, just because we haven't heard it, it shouldn't be, oh, well, I'm just going to discount that. So I'm going to use this as kind of also a lesson in for ourselves personally. Now, personally, when I'm doing Bible study and I look at a verse that I might see different than what I've heard taught before, one of the things I'll do is begin to search to see if any reputable Bible teacher throughout the years has seen it the same way, if they've held a different, similar view. Now, if they haven't, then that makes me question, you know, my own understanding of it. And even if I do find someone that confirms what I believe, that doesn't necessarily mean that I'm thinking rightly. So, you know, we've got to be careful and just make sure we double check those interpretations. So I was intrigued with this interpretation of Ephesians, even though once again, I'd never heard anybody take it that way. I thought, well, I'm going to consider it and let me start first with Scripture. Is there anything in Scripture that would lead us to believe that not letting the sun go down actually is not a reference to, you know, putting an end to that anger, but basically saying you need to hold on to righteous anger? So the first thing I found is there's a very similar statement. In fact, this statement might even be drawn a little bit from Deuteronomy chapter 24. Deuteronomy chapter 24, 14 and 15, it's speaking of a different subject, but it says, "You shall not oppress a hired servant who is poor and needy, whether one of your brethren or one of the aliens who is in your land within your gates. Each day you shall give him at his wages and not let the sun go down on it. For he is poor and has set his heart on it, lest he cry out against you to the Lord and it be sin to you." So we see here in this other reference, the letting the sun go down is really kind of like we think and usually how this would be taught, that you don't let the day end. And actually for the Jews, the sun going down was the start of the new day. So you don't let a new day start without dealing with the things that you need to deal with. In this case, it had to do with an employer and worker relationship. Now, another thing that I pondered as I thought about this as a possibility, Psalm 30 verse 5 says of God, "For his anger is but for a moment. His favor is for life. Weeping may endure for a night, but joy comes in the morning." And we also see that God's mercies are new every morning. So I'm inclined to say that particular teacher's interpretation so far doesn't seem to line up with what we learn from Scripture. But let me also point you to Psalm chapter 4, because the Apostle Paul, when he says, "Be angry and do not sin," he's actually quoting a psalm. And that's Psalm 4, verses, and I'm going to read verses 2 through 4. So you can kind of get a context here. It's this frustration as a righteous man against godlessness. And so this is helpful to know. He says, "How long, O you sons of men, will you turn my glory to shame? How long will you love worthlessness and seek falsehood? Selah. But know that the Lord has set apart for himself him who is godly. The Lord will hear when I call to him. Be angry and do not sin. Meditate within your heart on your bed and be still. Selah." Now, the interesting thing is Paul quotes from this, and we had hoped that just going back to Psalm 4 would shed some light and help, like, really define this for certain. Except there are different interpretations of Psalm 4, because Paul is actually quoting from the Greek version of the Old Testament, known as the Septuagint, and it reads so much different than the Hebrew version. Let me read some of these other translations. Some say tremble or stand in awe. So let me read. We see this in the New American Standard Bible. It actually reads, says, tremble and do not sin. Psalm 4:4 in the King James says, stand in awe and sin not. So you kind of wonder, well, wow, that's a lot different than being angry, you know, to stand in awe and tremble in the presence of God. So here are the two different interpretations of Psalm 4, which may give us some help and may not. Some believe, based on more of the Hebrew reading of it rather than the Greek reading of it, that it's a reference to the sinner that is being spoken out against, and that sinner had better stand in awe and tremble in God's presence, and when he goes to bed that night, he better ponder his sinful direction and choose to stop going headlong into sin and in rebellion to God. And so that's one idea about this. So tremble and do not sin. So the psalm is speaking out against sinners from the perspective of a righteous person. And so, hey, you know, before you go to bed, you better first of all get in the presence of God. You should tremble and you should not sin. And then you should sit on your bed, meditate those things, and be still before God, because he is a God of judgment, but he's also a God of mercy. And so if you'll turn from your ways, you'll receive mercy, but if you don't, there's judgment. Now, the other interpretation is based on the Greek version, which is what Paul actually quotes, which says, be angry. And that is the understanding of that would be then the anger is not, you know, it's the anger of the righteous man against the ungodly. And yet, with that anger, there's an importance to not fall into sin in that anger, meaning take that anger too far. But that you should really, if you're angry against sin and against the sinner, then you should ponder. You should go to bed and you should contemplate the presence of God and how that relates. And we should learn to be still, not to take things into, you know, too far and into our own hands. It reminds me of another psalm, Psalm 73, and I'm not going to read the whole psalm, but really, as David is expressing himself, this is a psalm about the frustration with how the ungodly seem to just get away with everything, and it seems like their lives are blessed, and everything's going well for them, and it's frustrating. He's kind of pulling out his hair going, I don't get it. Here I'm living a godly life, and I'm having trials and troubles, and the unbelievers who are opposed to God seem to be just going off scot-free, living a life, a cushy life. And so let's pick up what the conclusion of that psalm, Psalm 73, and I'm going to start with verse 12. It says, behold, these are the ungodly who are always at ease. They increase in riches. Surely I have cleansed my heart in vain and washed my hands in innocence. For all day long I have been plagued and chastened every morning. If I had said, I will speak thus, behold, I would have been untrue to the generation of your children. Meaning, like, if that's where it ends, if I'm just going to vent like that in my anger, then I would have spoken something that's untrue. And he's going to explain what he means. He says, when I thought how to understand this, it was too painful for me. And here's the answer. Verse 17, until I went into the sanctuary of God, then I understood their end. Surely you set them in slippery places. You cast them down to destruction. Oh, how they are brought to desolation, as in a moment they are utterly consumed with terrors. So the psalmist here shows, like, I'm not thinking right. Yes, I'm angry against sin, but when I stop and contemplate the end of those, where that all lasts, it's not what's going on now, but what will they face apart from God's mercy if they don't repent. That's terrifying. That's not a good end. So I shouldn't be worrying about how this is all going to play out in this world. I should be thinking, I should be pondering God. Now, the difference between this psalm and Psalm 4 is that Psalm 4 says, hey, meditate on these things while you're in bed and be still. Here, instead of doing it, going in the presence of God, even laying down in bed, he goes into the sanctuary. But he's still, it's the same end. He's going into the presence of God, and in that presence of God, realizes that God is a God of justice. He will bring about judgment for those who are not repentant. But he's ready to extend mercy to anyone who repents. And so that's important. Now, also what I did in just pondering this question and this particular interpretation of that passage is I went back and I read a ton of commentaries. I'm not going to burden you with those today, but one after another all pretty much said this: be angry and do not sin, really is in that context of there are times where you have a just cause to be angry, but you should not take it too far. And anger, if it's not submitted to the Lord, even righteous anger, if not submitted to God, then it can become what Paul talks about, a wrath, which is never appropriate. Wrath belongs to God, not to man. And so when we don't deal with our anger, even if it's righteous anger, then we could potentially put ourselves in a place of sin and then also give place to the devil. And so I'll just read a couple little quips here. Albert Barnes says about not letting the sun go down. He says, do not cherish anger. Do not sleep upon it. Do not harbor a purpose of revenge. Do not cherish ill will against another. When the sun sets on a man's anger, he may be sure it is wrong. F.F. Bruce, a great commentator on the scriptures, he says, here it is suggested that anger can be prevented from degenerating into sin if a strict time limit is placed on it. Do not let the sun go down in your anger. I love this quote by John Trapp. He was a teacher from the 17th century. He says, he that will be angry and not sin, let him be angry at nothing but sin. So there is an appropriate. So in some sense, I do agree that this anger here that's being mentioned is not anger against a person. It's not offense because someone hurt your feelings. This is about a righteous anger against things that are ungodly, things that are unjust, and that's appropriate. But even appropriate anger should not be harbored to the point of it turning into wrath. So we have to be careful. Also, if you can go back all the way into early church history, Chrysostom said the same thing. Let me just read a little bit of his. He says, he speaks first, being Paul, speaks first to prevent our sinning. If we do not listen, he does not abandon us. His role as a spiritual father does not allow him to give up on us easily. It's like the doctor who tells the sick person what he must do. If the patient refuses to hear him, he does not write him off. Rather, he continues to care for him by giving him further persuasive counsel. So too, Paul, as he already said, do not lie to one another. But suppose anger should arise from lying. Then he deals with this. What does he say? Be angry and do not sin. It is better not to grow angry at all, but if one ever does fall into anger, he should at least not be carried away by it towards something worse. Jerome also, who we came the Latin Vulgate from Jerome, Jerome pretty much agrees with this, says almost the same thing. And then one more time, I love this quote from Chrysostom. He says, do you wish to have your fill of anger? 1 hour or two or three is enough for you, but do not let the sun go down and leave you both as enemies. It was God's goodness that did not leave us in anger. He did not let us part in enmity. He shed his light upon those of us who were sinners. So when evening is coming on, be reconciled. So my conclusion here to this is that, first of all, I think it's good to consider alternate understandings, but you should be a Berean and dog it out. After trying to dog this one out, I would have to disagree with that particular teacher and his conclusion. I do believe he was right in saying that the anger should be anger against sin, but I don't believe that letting the sun not letting the sun go down in your anger means to hold on to it. I mean, I believe it means exactly the way a lot of the teachers have taught throughout history, is that it means you should let it go. You shouldn't harbor it. Okay, so that was a great question, and I've really enjoyed getting your questions. So if you've got one, please feel free to let me know. Send me an email, send me a text. And in fact, we have, by the way, we have new email addresses for the pastors. With our new website, we got email addresses, so you can send an email to PastorPhilip@lwfchurch.org. And so that's also an easy way. Okay, let's turn to Mark chapter 5. And I'd like to read this familiar story to us, and then I'll make a few comments on it. It pretty much speaks for itself. It says, "Then they came to the other side of the sea, to the country of the Gadarenes. And when he had come out of the boat, immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit, who had his dwelling among the tombs, and no one could bind him, not even with chains, because he had often been bound with shackles and chains, and the chains had been pulled apart by him, and the shackles broken in pieces. Neither could anyone tame him. And always, night and day, he was in the mountains and in the tombs, crying out and cutting himself with stones. When he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and worshipped him. And he cried out with a loud voice and said, 'What have I to do with you, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I implore you by God that you do not torment me.' For he said to him, 'Come out of the man, unclean spirit.' Then he asked him, 'What is your name?' And he answered, saying, 'My name is Legion, for we are many.' Also he begged him earnestly that he would not send them out of the country. Now a large herd of swine was feeding there near the mountains. So all the demons begged him, saying, 'Send us to the swine, that we may enter them.' And at once Jesus gave them permission. Then the unclean spirits went out and entered the swine. There were about 2,000, and the herd ran violently down the steep place into the sea and drowned in the sea. So those who fed the swine fled, and they told it to the city and in the country, and they went out to see what it was that had happened. Then they came to Jesus and saw the one who had been demon-possessed and had the legion, sitting and clothed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. And those who saw it told them how it happened to him and who had been demon-possessed and about the swine. Then they began to plead with him to depart from their region. And when he got into the boat, he who had been demon-possessed begged him that he might be with him. However, Jesus did not permit him, but said to him, 'Go home to your friends and tell them what great things the Lord has done for you and how he has had compassion on you.' And he departed and began to proclaim in Decapolis all that Jesus had done for him, and all marveled." So we have this very familiar story, and let's just go through it verse by verse and pull a few things out of here that are applicable to us and things that we can learn. The first is just more detail. You know, they had been in Capernaum, and Jesus said, "Let's cross over to the other side." And they come to this place called the Gadarenes. Now, Matthew calls it the country of the Gergesenes. And there's all these tedious debates of some Bible teachers that honestly, those kind of things give me a headache over the names of places. And, you know, was it this? Was it that? This ancient city? The cities don't, you know, many of these cities don't exist anymore. But they're, the main point is easy to figure out. They were in Capernaum. It's the Sea of Galilee. They crossed over to the other side. They came to a region. Now, this region would not have been Israel in God's original plan, because this was the other side of the Jordan, and the Israel were inheriting all the land on this side of it, not the side that they actually went to on this journey. But if you remember what had happened as they were coming into the promised land, they actually had a battle with some of the nations in that area on that side of the Jordan. And the land was very good. It was pasture land. And so several tribes, Reuben, the half-tribe of Manasseh, and I'm trying to remember the third one, Gad, duh, because we're talking about the Gadarenes. So Gad, Reuben, and the half tribe of Manasseh pleaded with Moses and God to say, "Hey, can we stay here? Can we stay on this side?" And so there were Jewish settlements on the other side. And when you look at maps, it doesn't actually appear that the section that was inherited by Gad went up that far, but nevertheless, makes sense to me if the Gadarenes had something to do with that. But it really doesn't matter. We know that these were Jewish people over on that side of the Sea of Galilee. But the most important thing is why Jesus crossed over. Not where, but why. He crossed over because he was on a mission to set a man free. I love in Luke chapter 4, when Jesus preached his first public sermon, he quoted from Isaiah, and he says, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He has sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captive." That was Jesus' calling. That was what his anointing was for, to proclaim liberty to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord. So this was prophesied of the Messiah. This was going to be his mission, to proclaim liberty and to set people free who are oppressed by the devil. And this is really the most remarkable story of someone being set free and a fulfillment of this prophecy. And so verse 2, it says, "And when he had come out of the boat, immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit." Now, we get a clue here. I mentioned last week that this storm that rose up all of a sudden, the wind that Jesus rebuked. Remember, he rebuked the wind, and then he spoke peace to the sea. Two different things. And so why would he rebuke the wind that whipped up? It's interesting that this man, or the demons, or both, seem to know Jesus is coming. His presence is recognized even while he was afar off. And that has led me to believe, and many other Bible teachers, that storm that arose out on the Sea of Galilee was a demonic storm, an opposition, knowing that once Jesus lands, it's all over. They have no authority. Jesus has all authority, and they knew that there was going to be a face-off, and it was a face-off they couldn't win. And so there was this opposition. And so whether that's the case is not the main point, but it's food for thought. In verse 3, it says, "He who had been dwelling among the tombs, and no one could bind him, not even with chains." I don't know if you've seen pictures of the catacombs, but if you've seen pictures of various catacombs, they're subterranean, but they are caves that have been carved out, and you go into rooms, and along the hallways and even these rooms that have been carved out, you'll see that the tombs are actually carved out. The best I could describe it, if you haven't seen these, are like bunk beds. You know, maybe that's not the best thing for you kids who live in bunk beds, you know, but at night. But basically, they're just little spots carved out of the rock, one on top of the other, on top of the other, and just enough room to lay a dead body. And so the catacombs are just filled with these little nooks to lay people in. Now, we see that in this occasion, these tombs are not necessarily underground like the catacombs. They're above ground, which was also typical. The Jews buried their dead as opposed to burning people like a lot of the pagans did. So they built these nooks, and it could have also been caves into the side of the rock with the same thing. You go in and you're going to find all these. Well, it was known that these cave dwellings, just like the catacombs, became places for robbers, for people wanting to stay out of view of other people. It's like somewhere you wouldn't go. You know, you're not going to take your wife on a date to the tombs, you know, or the catacombs. This is not a family field trip that you go on. It's something that people avoid. There's a bunch of dead people. Plus, they had, you know, the Jews as well as the pagans all had their ideas about spirits and tombs, and so. It was a creepy place, you know, that you wouldn't want to be. But this is where the man is living. He's living among the tombs. He's actually taking shelter in these caves or using an empty little nook to lay in at night just to cover himself. And that was his dwelling place. You know, Jesus was also buried in a tomb, but it was a deluxe version, you know, so the wealthier people could have their own. So think of the difference between a private dwelling and an apartment complex, you know. So these tombs or the catacombs were like the apartment complex. You know, it's like you're going to have to share it with a lot of other dead people. Whereas Jesus' tomb was made for just one person. You know, it was a rich man's tomb that was donated to the ministry, so to speak. And of course, Jesus only used it for 3 days. And so it was a short term lease. But in Mark 5, verse 4, it says, because he had often been bound with shackles and chains, and the chains had been pulled apart by him and the shackles broken in pieces, neither could anyone tame him. Another unique thing about this story is this demonstrates that this man had demonic supernatural strength. And that shouldn't surprise us that the spiritual world can have an effect in the physical world. Now, because it's to be able to pull apart. It doesn't say that this man was a Hulk. It doesn't say he was, you know, a big bodybuilder. You get the picture when you hear of a thin, emaciated, bloody, impoverished man. Not someone who would have even the strength to break chains. Well, he didn't have strength in himself to break chains and to tear shackles that were meant to actually keep prisoners imprisoned. And yet this man could tear them off. Supernatural strength. We see that this can be demonic, but it could also be from the Lord. Samson is an example of a man that God gave supernatural strength. Samson's strength was not because he was a bodybuilder. We don't know what he looked like, but I'm convinced he didn't look like a bodybuilder, like the movies and the books portray him. And the reason why is the people that were opposing him could not figure out where his strength came from. If he looked like the Hulk, then you would just say, wow, man, I want to know what this guy's workout, you know, program is. But what is he eating? What kind of protein powder does he put in his smoothies, you know? But that was not the case. They kind of scratched their heads saying, well, we don't know where he gets his strength. There was nothing apparent in his physical form that would show him as like stronger than other people. We know that that physical strength that Samson had came from the Spirit of God. So you can have the good kind of spiritual strength from the Spirit of God, and you could have, and we have other stories too. Elijah, at one point when he runs and outruns a chariot, is another example of God giving someone some supernatural strength. Once again, Elijah, we don't believe to be some amazing long-distance runner. He was a prophet. I'm sure he was fit, but nevertheless, that story is another example of something that is just not normal, you know, and it's told to give us the impression that it wasn't normal. But spirits do have the ability to do supernatural things through a physical body. And this man, not only did he have this strength, but he was also always crying out, cutting himself with stones. And it says he was exceedingly fierce. So no one could even pass. Nobody wanted to be around. Who would want to? I'm telling you, you know, not only would you not want to be visiting the tombs, but if you knew this man was around, you're like, we are definitely going around that vicinity because this man is crazy. He's always screaming. He's bloody. He's got supernatural strength. People have tried to chain him and he breaks the chains. Sounds like a dangerous person. And it says always night and day he was in the mountains and the tomb. So he's roaming around the area too. He's not even contained in one place. He's roaming around and it's a terror to people. But really the terror was going on in this own man's life. He was tormented. He was alone in the tombs crying out. Of course, you know, Matthew actually tells us there were two men, but this in the other Gospels, this one man seems to be this more significant of the two, and they focus in on his story. He was crying out, he was cutting himself, but most important to understand, this man was misunderstood, deeply misunderstood, because chains were not the answer to his problem. You see, Man sometimes tries to deal with these issues with his own reasoning. Okay, we got a man who's wild and out of control. Let's try to subdue him with chains, not realizing that the man is already chained. That's the problem. The man has been chained spiritually, and he needs to be set free. He didn't need shackles. The man needed freedom. But who's going to give him that? He didn't need to be tamed like some wild animal. He needed a storm in his life to be rebuked. He needed the stormy seas to be calmed. That's what he needed. And that's the reason Jesus crossed over. It was for this very mission. And his presence, the presence of Jesus even halfway across the sea, was already known on the other side. Once again, they knew he had authority, and they knew this was a face-off they couldn't win. And so really, the most important thing in this story that we're going to see is a story of compassion. The most despised, if you had to pick, like, who's the most vile person in the Bible, maybe there would be a top 10, but I would say this man would probably be in the top 10, if not in the top 5, if not towards the very top, of a person who's messed up, they're vile, but ultimately needs compassion. And everyone else, how is everyone else responding to this man? They're responding in the wrong way. Jesus is the only one who responds in the right way, and he makes a journey just for this man for the purpose of showing him compassion and setting him free. That's not the tendency for decent folks, right? You know, it's like we want to avoid people like this, for sure, you know, or even lesser than this extreme. So we need to learn from Jesus. Let us today learn from Jesus and how he responds to this man. It's remarkable. You know, the disciples on their way over didn't know what they were going to be facing. And they didn't know about that storm. And we learned that they didn't have faith to even believe that Jesus had the power to speak to the wind, to rebuke it, and to have the wind obey him, and to speak peace and watch the sea calm. So they didn't even know that. It caused them exceeding fear, it says, that really frightened them. So you wonder, do you think that they believed that Jesus had the power to set this man free? They had seen Jesus cast out demons, but this was an exceptional case. But the real question is for us, do we believe that Jesus can redeem the vilest person on the planet today? I don't know about you, but I believe he can. And I believe he wants to. I believe that the most lost, desperately wicked person, bound in sin and chains, while they have life, while they have breath, have hope in Jesus Christ. They only have hope in Jesus Christ. And only until Jesus crosses over. And of course, how is he going to do that? Well, he's going to do that through his hands and his feet, you know, until his people begin to go on mission to say, you know what? God hasn't called me just to wall my life in and create a barrier from everybody who's vile and sinful, but he has called us to actually do the very thing he did and show compassion. And by the power of the Holy Spirit, see people set free from their chains. That same authority that Jesus has, he has given to the church. He's given to you and I. We have it in the name of Jesus to be able to confront demonic powers, keeping people bound. We have the ability to preach the gospel. But most importantly, we need to have compassion. And it says that, and let me just fast forward. When this man wants to follow Jesus, And who wouldn't want to in his case? Jesus tells him to stay, and he says, this is the one thing I want you to go out and tell people, what the Lord has done in your life and how he has shown you compassion. And that's the testimony, that someone had compassion on me. This man needed compassion. We all need compassion. But sometimes we think, oh, well, that person, I don't know, they're not deserving of compassion. Well, let this story be a reminder to us that if we ever think that someone's not worthy of compassion, we're in the wrong. Because the greater the darkness, the more need for freedom and compassion. And Jesus demonstrated that in this story. You know, Jesus said that of the church, he says, greater works will you do? Well, are you ready for some of those greater works? We always like to think of these greater works being, you know, something really, really remarkable that's going to make it in the, you know, the front page of the newspapers or something that'll be written up on a blog or something. But we don't think of those greater works being, yeah, you will also go past your comfort zone and enter into the space of people that are vile in order to see them set free from sin and the chains of the enemy. And that scares us. I'm sure it scared the disciples. Now, we don't know how much backstory. I mean, we don't have a lot of backstory about this man. We have a little bit. But who knows? I mean, it's okay to, I mean, this is, I'm not going to, I can't quote chapter and verse here, but I like to imagine that it's very possible that this man in his misery, I'd like to imagine that even that night before, he is possibly just crying out to God, going, I am such a wreck. I'm a vile man. I'm a hopeless case. I am miserable. Will please have mercy on me. You know, we don't know that cry did or didn't go up, but whether it did or not, Jesus answered. Jesus answered, and he crossed the sea to meet this man. Because the Father knew. Everybody else is looking at the situation wrongly, but God the Father knew the horrible situation this man was in. Now, in the Old Testament, there were times that God raised up enemies to Israel to discipline them. So he would raise up a nation or a king, and he would say, okay, I'm going to use them. They're going to be my arm of justice, and they're going to bring discipline against my wayward people in order to provoke them, to help them turn back to me. Now, there were several occasions in the Old Testament where these nations that God used went too far. They kind of reveled in their cause, and they took things too far. And then we see in the prophets, God then rebuking these nations and saying, you know what? I was using you, but you went too far, and now you're in trouble. And you are going to receive my discipline for going out of bounds. Now, certainly, the demons are allowed. God has allowed them to be in the world. Jesus has authority over them, and everywhere he went, he cast them out. So there was an allowance here, but certainly this is a case where these demons had gone too far. And basically God is saying, enough is enough. And when are we going to get to that place in our own lives where we see all the things falling apart around us, and with compassion we say, enough is enough. People need to be set free. They need to meet Jesus. They need to find mercy from him. And God has called us to co-labor with him. He took his disciples. He wanted his disciples to see this. He didn't go alone. He took, as far as I know, all 12 of them in that boat to the other side. Verse 6, it says, when he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and worshiped him. You know, what do you think was going through the disciples' mind when they see a wild, out of control, bloody, emaciated man, crazed, out of his mind, running towards Jesus? I'm thinking, did I sign up for the wrong mission trip here? You know, I'm like, you know, it was interesting in the news, talking about mission trips, and I'm not trying to make light of this. It was just in the, you might have saw, it was either last week or the week before, there was a boy who had contracted hookworms really bad. Did you see this in news? Okay, so it was in the news because it was terrible. It was a terrible case of hookworms that he got while on a mission trip. And that was in the news story. So it kind of caught my attention. So the boy's on a mission trip. He got hookworms. And now it is this terrible effect. And so he's in the news. But then I was reading the story. And I'm like, so on his mission trip, his friends were on the beach in Florida. And they buried him up to his head. And that's when he got the hookworms. I'm thinking, what kind of mission trip is that? You're going with your buddies, your friends to the, maybe they did something else and that was just the side thing. But I was like, wow, yeah, there's a mission trip and then there's a mission trip. You know, there's the one where you end up in the news because you get hookworms because you're playing on the beach and getting buried up into your neck in sand. And there's the mission trip where you cross over the Sea of Galilee and you meet a naked, crazed, bloody man running towards you. That's a mission trip, you know, and that's exactly what the disciples, but it's interesting that the man falls down at Jesus' feet and it says he worships him. Now, it's difficult to know if this compulsion to meet Jesus was on the part of the demons who knew they had to face him or whether this was on the part of the man who was severely demon possessed and had a stronger desire to be set free. We really don't know. It's not clear. It's actually quite confusing to know what's the demon, what's the man. There are times where we get a clue. So let's look at the story a little bit further because there are several. Now, earlier we saw in Mark 3, verse 10 through 12, it says, he healed many so that as many had afflictions pressed about him to touch him. And the unclean spirits, whenever they saw him, fell down before him and cried out, saying, you are the Son of God. But he sternly warned them that they should not make him known. So this actually was a common occurrence for the demons themselves to come and fall down at Jesus' feet. So in this case, we can't just assume, well, this is the man falling down. No, it seems like this could be the demons coming and falling down at Jesus' feet because he is Lord of all. He's preeminent over all creation, and they know it better than sometimes we know it. It says the demons believe in God and Satan believes in God and they tremble. They tremble in the presence of God because they know he has absolute authority. So this man comes running. We don't know who's compelling him to run, whether it's his own desire, whether it's the demons. But we do know he falls before Jesus and he is and he worships Jesus. Mark verse 7, it says, and he cried out with a loud voice and said, what have I to do with you, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I implore you by God that you do not torment me. Now, this apparently is the demon, the chief one who is speaking as a representative for the legion, because we see in the next verse, it says that this came as a response to Jesus saying to the demon, come out of the man, unclean spirit. So that was the first agenda point. Right away, Jesus says, just come out of this man. And then Jesus gets some pushback. Now, we don't often see this. This is one of these, a rare case where it doesn't come out right away and Jesus gets pushback. And so we read this statement, you know, what have I to do with you, Jesus, Son of the Most High God, I implore you by God that you do not torment me. Then he asked him, what is your name? And he answered saying, my name is Legion, for we are many. So Jesus does some probing. He gets even deeper here. And he uncovers the story that this is not a single demon. You know, demons, Satan is the father of lies, deceptive. And so you can imagine that there might be some ploy like, okay, maybe one of us have to leave. Who's going to, you know, one of the demons is getting pushed forward. All right, who's going out? You know, and trying to keep, you know, hey, if one of us has to go, at least there's like 5,999 left of us, you know, to torment this man. But Jesus doesn't stop there. He says, what's your name? All right, declare what's going on here. And they have to obey. They can't hide it. Okay, gig's up. We're a legion. We are actually a horde of demons working together. And they've come out like a gang, you know, and this is our name. We've named ourselves Legion. Now a legion, and after this point, by the way, the spokesman demon is no longer using the singular but the plural. A Roman legion was approximately 6,000. We don't know whether there was actually 6,000 demons or if it was just, that's a large number. And a legion is a group that is together for military purposes, and this was a war. Mark tells us that the swine were about 2,000, and so we can at least say that there's a lot of demons in this man. And since they are spirits and not, and the man is physical, then the physical body obviously can have multiple demonic spirits. Now in verse 10, it says he being the demon, the chief spokesperson or spokesdemon, said he begged him earnestly that he would not send them out of the country. Now in Luke, it actually says they begged him that he would not command them to go out into the abyss. The abyss in Revelation is called the bottomless pit. This is where the this is the place reserved for the devil and his angels. And there is a time when every evil spirit is going to be locked up for eternity in that abyss. And they know that. Their time is coming. And so that is what is the rub here. It's like, wow, don't, I mean, you're not going to do this now. I mean, we know that this is coming, but you're not going to do this now, are you? I mean, are you, we didn't know this was part of the plan. They are actually fearful that it's up for them for all of eternity. And so they're begging him, don't do this. Don't send us out into the abyss. And they said now, and then verse 11 here, it says, now a large herd of swine was feeding there near the mountains. So all the demons begged him, saying, send us to the swine that we may enter them. This is also a bizarre and a unique occurrence. We don't see this elsewhere in Scripture, but that the demons say, hey, we're going to possess, you know, why don't you allow us, give us permission to possess these animals. Now, by the way, Jesus does immediately give them permission, maybe because he knew something that they didn't know. We don't know whether the demons knew that their intention was to drive this whole herd of swine into the sea and drown them. I don't know why, other than it was just malicious. But it's also possible they didn't know that by entering into a bunch of dumb animals that they were going to respond a little bit different than the man responded. And they were going to just be carried off headlong into the sea, which is interesting because we have very little didactic teaching about demons. God intended that. He doesn't intend us to delve deep into this. We have what we have in Scripture, and that's enough. But Jesus, when he did do a little teaching about casting out demons, he says they, you know, when a demon is cast out, it's like being evicted from a home. And it says it goes through, and the New American Standard actually says waterless places. So they like dry, arid, deserty places for whatever reason. There are conjectures about that. But nevertheless, Jesus said they actually roam through dry, waterless places. So I don't think that the demons were probably wanting to take a quick trip into the Sea of Galilee through their herd of swine. I don't know. We don't have those details. But they do. So it says, Jesus gave them permission, and the unclean spirits went out, entered the swine. There were about 2,000. The herd ran violently down the steep place into the sea and drowned in the sea. So that's, you imagine that type of torment. Torment's a 2,000 swine go batty. They go nuts. And yet that all of those demons were in that one man. And he was still alive, surprisingly. In verse 14, it says, so those who fed the swine fled, and they told it in the city and in the country. So there were just like you have shepherds, goat herds, you have swine herds. So these were probably younger, hired people. In fact, a lot of the shepherds are very young, and that's their job. They just live out with the animals, and so they're just hired to do that. And you can imagine what their shock was when they see their herd that they're responsible for keeping an eye on all go hurling over into the sea and drowned. So they rush off to go report this, and they don't just report it once. It says that they went and spread this everywhere, so that eventually a multitude actually shows up. says verse, so that when it was told in the city and the country, they went out to see what had happened. In Luke 8:37, it actually mentions a multitude. So this is a large gathering of people. It's the biggest news in the region, especially since it involved 2,000 pigs now bobbing up and down in the Sea of Galilee, and a man who they knew was previously untamable, who is now different. And so in verse 15, this is what they find. They came to Jesus and saw the one who had been demon-possessed and had the legion sitting and clothed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. And I want to point out that he was sitting, clothed in his right mind, but he wasn't just sitting anywhere. Luke fills us in that it says he was sitting at the feet of Jesus. Sitting at the feet of Jesus, clothed. Where did he get the clothes? The man was naked. Someone had to give up their clothes. Someone had to show compassion and say, okay, between 13 of us, let's pull together something. Or maybe they had an extra change of clothes in the boat. But they pulled together what they had, and they gave this man some dignity because he had been so misused by the demons for so long. They were like, let's not only, we've got, he's set free, but there's also some practical needs right at hand. He needs to get clothed. And so they helped clothe him. And you can imagine the sight of these people as they come out. I don't know what it'd look like to see 2,000 floating dead pigs in the surf, but it's got to be pretty impressive. I mean, just like a car wreck, you know, people, gawkers. I mean, people want to come and see it. They want to see what that looks like, to see 2,000 swine out in the Sea of Galilee, but they also want to see this man who's been transformed. And the reaction of the people is fear. They're terrified of what has happened. Now, I don't know how long that man had been sitting at the feet of Jesus, but this is not going to happen like in minutes. People are not going to amass from the country, from the cities. So it seems like this could have been going on all day. But here's the man sitting at the feet of Jesus, just soaking in. I'm sure Jesus is ministering to him, teaching him, showing more compassion, just loving on him. But yet the multitude's response was they were fearful. And so verse 16, those who saw it told them how it happened to him who had been demon-possessed and about the swine. And they began to plead with him to depart from their region. They asked Jesus to depart. Can you believe it? Can you believe that? And why? They're afraid, and their region has just lost 2,000, you know, swine. And it's like, what's next? This can be very costly to have this guy around here if we're going to see our livestock being thrown into the sea. They seem to be more concerned about the pigs than they were this man. But nevertheless, they wanted to depart, and Jesus shakes the dust off his feet. Or, you know, he's like, mission's accomplished. I'm not going to stick around here. He departs. Don't be surprised, by the way, when you bring Jesus, the presence of Jesus, into places where people are comfortable in their sin, that they're going to be uncomfortable with you. And in fact, sometimes so much uncomfortable that they're going to want you to be out of their presence. You see, because these people, if you think about this aspect of Israel on the other side of the Jordan, all of Israel struggled throughout their years to stay true to God. But one of the biggest concerns about that group over there was that they're on the other side. They're kind of removed from everybody else. And the tendency for them to go wayward quicker. And so we don't really know where they were at this point, but they're Jews. Why would there be 2,000 swine, you know, unless there was a little compromise somewhere, you know, in their lives? So we can see, too, that, come on, whatever's going on, you know, the power. And it's not that Jesus came to maliciously send 2,000 swine into the sea. He was there to set that man free, but that was a consequence of it. Now this man, it says, when he got into the boat, he who had been demon-possessed begged him that he might be with him. And of course he did. We would want to be with Jesus too. If you just had gone through that kind of horror story, I think just out of safety, you would want to be near Jesus. I'm like, I think sometimes we get fearful when we've been delivered from something. And I'm not talking about demons, you know. I don't know if any of you have ever been delivered from a demon or not. But if you had, I suppose there could be a fear like, wow, what happens? But Jesus had taught, hey, when the house is empty, it needs to be filled. It needs to be filled with the Spirit of God. And when it's filled, then you're okay. He says, but if that empty house is not filled, then seven demons, spirits worse than the first, come and take the abode. So there could be this fear like, wow, without Jesus around, could this get worse for me in the future? But Jesus assured him, you're going to be okay. You're going to be okay. I've got a mission for you. And I'm going to tell you what I want you to do. And so he says, go home to your friends. Tell them what great things the Lord has done for you and how he has had compassion on you. And the man did it. It says he departed, began to proclaim in Decapolis. Decapolis were the 10 cities in that region. So he doesn't just go to one place. He says, I'm just going to go city to city. It's a city by city, region-wide campaign. And he becomes an evangelist. But what I love about this man's evangelistic efforts was, what is he doing? He's just sharing his testimony. He's got no Bible school or seminary training. He's not gone to Toastmasters to learn how to give a good speech. He's just told to go out and tell others what the Lord has done in his life, how he had had compassion. And I want to encourage you that's you can do the very same thing. Some of you may feel, well, I'm not a preacher, I'm not a teacher, but every one of you who have experienced the love, the forgiveness, the compassion of Jesus Christ in your life can share that with somebody else. You see, long before I was a pastor or a teacher, 28 years ago, the Lord set me free, and I began to do nothing. All I could do was share my story. It's all I had to share. And so I began sharing that story. For 28 years, I've been sharing the story of how Jesus Christ set me free. And it was interesting. I recently had an opportunity to be interviewed for a podcast, a brand new podcast called Compelled. It's produced by Paul Hastings, if anybody knows Paul. And so Tuesday, that episode's going to air. I'll ask Pastor Nathan to send out a link, you know, through the church. But all it is just me sharing my testimony. But if you haven't heard it before, what you're going to hear is the same story I've been telling for 28 years. It's the best story I have because it's the story of God having compassion on me when I was a sinner. And so this man, that was what Jesus sent him on the mission. Just go share with people. You don't need Bible school. You don't need seminary training. You just need to obey God and be willing to share with others what God has done with you. And so Jesus made this trip for this one man. Now, as we close, we're gonna have a communion in a moment together. But before we do this, I've asked our media team to play a video. And this is a song, one of my favorite songs by a singer that the younger generation doesn't know about. But any of you who are my age or maybe a little older, you will know who Bob Bennett is. And Bob Bennett has a song called Man of the Tombs, which I believe I probably could just skip the sermon and played this for you and made it easier on my sermon prep this week because it's very powerful. I had the privilege of meeting Bob Bennett, having a dinner with him, and spending an evening with him up in Beloit, Wisconsin many years ago. And so I hope you're blessed by this. And then as soon as the video is done, we'll have our time of communion.